filing with the sheriff some fee, that he will come out and move the tenant out, the bodies, and then you can go with a moving company or other arrangements that you make without posting a bond and move the goods to a place of safekeeping. And we have been very careful in writing this portion of the statute to try to determine that this, in doing this, that you must have these things put in a place of safekeeping. Now, if you would mind going back to the abandoned property section with me, which is back on page 4, I wanted to bring to your attention, 4 and 5, that what we did in allowing for this, what we call self-help provision, we set out how to handle those people's goods so carefully that we had hoped that a landlord does not get a slap on the hands from a tenant who thinks that his goods were not handled properly. We have under the present law where the tenant's goods are moved by the sheriff and a storage company to a place of safekeeping in a storage place, what is called an exemption list. And on that exemption list, there is primarily almost everything that the person could ever use or want on it, and they have up to 15 days to go get these things out of the place of storage free. Under this section of the abandoned goods and with the new Section 9, we allow the tenant, when we move the goods ourselves and we take care of them, to come in within 15 days and personally pick those things up free of charge, no matter whether we move them to a place of safekeeping ourselves or not. Also in the statute, it is allowed that if they let you know within 15 days that they are coming to get the stuff, they have an extra 15 days to pick it up. Now, this is the way it is in the law with the exemption list also. So what we have done is primarily done this. You can either go with the present law, pay the bond or the down payment of $150, $200 a room, have a storage company and the sheriff come out, move everything. They get the exemption list. They have up to 30 days to get these things out, and then they go up for sale. Or the landlord can, provided under the law, let the sheriff come out, move the people out. They move the stuff to a place of safekeeping. The landlord then keeps it up to either the 15 or the 30 days. The tenant can come and get it free of charge. And we have provided for double penalties here it's statutory damages if the landlord tries to stop the tenant from getting his stuff and says you have to pay your back rent or pay anything within that time period. But beyond that time period, then the landlord has the right to get the judgment to get his fees back if it cost him to move that stuff. And it's a trade-off that we have, but it is so much less expensive for those landlords who might have a couple of good-sized teenage kids and a pickup and a storage shed somewhere to move these people's things out. We also...
Yes, Senator Monroe.
So it'd be the landlord's option whether you use basically the existing method or whether you use the new method allowed under
Absolutely.
Here.
Neither. You have to use one or the other.
Yeah, certainly.
But it is an option for the landlord.
Okay.
And then on page 5, we've made an effort. We could not get a hold harmless clause, but we did ask for some language that would give the judge some idea that if the landlord made a good faith effort and went through, you know, literally section by section of this and said, well, now I've sent the envelopes and I've done what I'm supposed to do, that complete compliance and good faith with the section on abandoned goods would release them from the tenants coming back on an action for the lost $10,000 diamond ring that might have been in that, the antique goods that were there. Now, we have had problems where landlords, you know, have possibly disposed of goods in an improper way, and we've tried very hard to set this out very clearly. And our association, at least the members of our association, will have... we are going to make a very big effort to get this information out to them so that they can understand how to use the section. Now, if I may move on, Section 10? Section 10 permits a person serving an FED a summons by nail and mail to insert a date of first appearance on the summons. Now, primarily what this means is that the court now is inserting the date and handing this over to a process server, and they are going out into the field and serving this either in person, or rather than having to go back, they have the date in there and they just nail and mail it. And Section 11 is a tie-in with this. Presently, under the 1980 ORCP, Oregon Revised Civil Procedures Act, most of the local governments are using process servers, but there was an Attorney General's opinion that only sheriffs could serve the FED. And so what we have done here is try to bring the statute in line with the Oregon Revised Civil Procedures Act. The reality of it is municipal governments are broke. They're using process servers rather than the sheriff's time. Generally, we lose time as landlords in the process serving of this, but in some cases we find that there is a lot. We actually get them served. We're having problems getting them served in some areas of the state because the sheriffs just can't get around to get out there, and private process servers will help. And also we have added, because of the Bob Harris scandal, an affidavit of service language in here so that it shows that they actually have served this, whether it's nail and mail or personal.
I'm not sure how much that would help in that situation. That some of the cases that Michael brought to our attention last year on sale of homes for $250 had just dandy affidavits of service on them, didn't
those
they?
Were certificates.
Well, didn't they, Mike?
I believe they did, Senator Gardner. What can I say?
Okay.
I think that you have other legislation that right. has been
that
addressing that, which you were
that we do.
Strong mover on, I believe, Senator Gardner. We hope that this doesn't create a problem, and we would be willing to come back certainly within the next 18 months after the session closes to correct it, but we are trying to get these things through. All right, and more quickly here, the last section requires the court to permit an unrepresented defendant to proceed to trial by filing a form answer. There has never been a form answer for the defendants. And what we primarily have done here, we were presented with a two-page form answer from Legal Aid originally that it listed everything that could possibly ever have gone wrong in the world, and we ended up with this simplistic, simple language form answer. And everyone is comfortable with it. Anyone with a fairly low reading level should be able to at least get this interpreted so they could write in. And to cover those people that are unrepresented who have the low reading level, we have added on page 10, section 7, that says if an unrepresented defendant files an answer and he writes in this thing, he still can. This is not limiting his defenses. I understand by talking to a number of the people who do work as attorneys on both sides for landlords and tenants that most judges will allow any defense to be brought up anyway. It should be of some help to the landlords to know what defense they're going to bring up. And if they fill in that their plumbing didn't work, maybe they can go back and find some receipts.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Gardner.
Michael, how do you envision that form being operating? Do you envision a typical case they would come into your office and you would be in a situation either to not help them because of income or do you see that these, how are these forms going to get to the tenants? At the court?
Yes, they'll be at the court, and landlords envision essentially at the time of first appearance, which is an odd proceeding in FED. It's odd compared to the rest of civil procedure. They'll have a pad of them, essentially. And the tenant says, I want to go to trial, the judge will
hand you the pad and then you fill it out right there.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. There is one other point I'd like to bring to your attention, and this was added in by the Judiciary Committee on page 7, line 35. Up until this time, wait, that's not the right place, is it?
Mm-hmm.
That they can bring it in by the plaintiff? Proceed to trials. Where'd it go? Lost it.
What are you asking about?
Well, I'm asking about a portion that we changed. We added in that the a lawyer can now file the complaint.
At the bottom of page 7, at the top of page 8.
Okay. Oh, there it is. Well, I was close enough. Thank you. That was great. Anyway, that's
sometimes
been a problem.
Sometimes you don't think we're awake.
I know you're awake on this, Bill. that's been a problem in the past where an attorney could not file, and now they can. And the Judiciary Committee just offered that one. They thought that was one that should be done, considering that there were a number of attorneys on the committee, well, and we were happy.
Well, you look at page 8, line 8. That language seems a little strange. Shall, is there some, is there an object to the word store? A verbal object?
It's supposed to be the shall store, they shall store, shall notify, and shall dispose of.
He's right, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, notify, store, that should come before store.
We could say shall notify the tenant and store and dispose of.
Yeah, that's the best way to say it. Notify the tenant, store and dispose of the goods.
Well,
I think that's great.
They're supposed to do each of those separate acts pursuant to ORS 91.840, aren't they? So
yes.
Probably shouldn't say the landlord shall store goods. I don't know whether you want to an article there or not. Shall store the goods?
Well, see, the goods, chattels, motor vehicles, and other personal property are part of what they store.
Well, wait a second. Shall store the goods, notify the tenant. Well, I don't know. That's a bad language anyway.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
How about if you just add shall before notify and add shall before dispose? Landlord shall store, shall notify the tenant, and shall dispose of the goods, et cetera, et cetera.
That's what it's meant to do.
Mr. Chairman, if we didn't do anything, would Legislative Council correct the grammar?
Well, that's where it came from.
Well, I hate to pass one. You know, we always get stuck when you pass out something that has some stupid language in it, and you get called on it on the floor. So the landlord shall store, shall notify the tenant, and shall dispose of the goods, chattel, mortgage, and so forth, pursuant to ORS. So we just stick a shall.
That's still not an object for store. If we're going to be technically correct, we probably should put the notify the tenant before the store.
That's the best way to phrase it. Michael had a better phraseology, I thought.
No. How about the landlord
shall notify the tenant
and shall store and dispose of the goods.
Right.
Okay.
The landlord shall, and we cross out store, shall notify the tenant and
shall
store and, which we insert before dispose, shall store and.
Yes.
Okay?
Okay.
Now, any other questions of the witnesses?
Gosh.
We did it, kid.
We must be doing it to the upper income tenants. That's the only thing I can figure out about.
No,
we
locked ourselves in a room, Senator Gardner, and said we're not going to come out until we get something.
We spent over 60 hours together on this bill. And we have poor grammar, but we certainly did work hard.
Did we move those, the amendments, the technical amendments? Did you need those?
Can you do that now?
Yes.
Or do you want to do that?
I'd move those, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Senator Gardner moves the amendments, which are laid out on as 2560A-3 plus the amendment we just made impromptu. Like, are there any objections to the amendments? If not, they're so.
And I'll move it to the floor.
Well, we got a couple of other people.
Okay,
in the
fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to, so we don't run out of time here. Oh, they're the only ones. Okay. Senator Gardner moves House Bill 2560A to the floor with a recommendation that do pass as amended. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, clerk, call roll.
Senator Gardner.
Aye.
Senator Hanlon.
Aye.
Senator Hannan.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Simmons.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Motion is adopted. Now we'll go to 2864. I should say that we had intended to take up 2521 today. We held it until this morning's session in anticipation of an amendment which Senator Hanlon had requested. When we got the amendment from Legislative Council rather late, it did not was not as Senator Hanlon had requested it, and I will hope that we will be able, in prompt fashion, I will circulate the amendment to the members of the committee so that we can promptly act on it at what is scheduled to be our last meeting on Wednesday. Although we've got another bill in here, and I don't know how we're going to get it done. All right, 2864 relates to the revision of the laws with reference to LID procedures when they are used by metropolitan service districts. And in response to our discussion at the meeting, when we heard the bill, you have proposed amendments, and I hope you have a copy with those hand engrossed. And these are laid out, and the amendments indicated as House Bill 2864-4. On page 3 of the printed House amendments, dated June 11th, line 4, after the period, was at the end of the phrase which described the response card. We then add the phrase, each response card shall be coded to identify the parcel property owned and shall specify that it must bear the signature of the property owner in order to be counted. And I think that was the intention of the return card, and Senator Gardner moves that amendment to House Bill 2864.
Chairman.
Senator Gardner?
Yeah. Before. This amendment and the bill as amended, as I recall, met both the concerns of the requesters of it and the people promoting it, and also was acceptable to the Metropolitan Service District.
That's true. Any further discussion? Is there objection to the amendment? If not, yes?
I would have preferred it just said shall identify the parcel rather than be coded to, but I don't think it's material.
The difference here, of course, was that they didn't want to have to lay out on each card the complete description, but instead they wanted to find out whether or not the person who signed it was indeed the owner of that property and how much, what an extent that property represented, because you had to account for 50% of the property.
I suppose if it's a meets and bounds description, it could be quite lengthy.
Yeah, so I think this is a better way to do it.
There's no objection then to the adoption of the amendment. It's adopted. And Senator Gardner moves House Bill 2864 to the floor with a recommendation to do pass as amended. If there's no further discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Gardner?
Aye.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Simmons?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. The motion is adopted. Now let's return to 3132. And we have testimony from Barbara Kamps. And Tom Meek.
Barbara Kahn, State of Oregon Real Estate Division. The Real Estate Division administers the Oregon condominium laws. And I've asked Jack Monroe to respond to the question earlier on 3132 with respect to where it actually came from.
Before you do this, could I ask, are there any proposed amendments
to 3132? Yes, excuse me. Yes, I brought over just some reference material. I realize you won't really have time to deal with it, but some packets, and within there are proposed amendments, which we rather ran out of time over in the House side, but amendments which our office as administer and his draft of 3132 feel are kind of important to.
Are these the ones, Jack, that toughen up the disclosure provisions? Or those are other amendments?
Toughen up the disclosure.
Yeah, there's been.
Those are not the same amendments.
I'm not sure if there are other amendments.
I think Representative Gold was dealing with the changes that were originally proposed in 3132, and we're delighted that the Housing House Committee was very receptive to most of the information and the provisions in 3132. You have a time problem.
Because of our time problem, can you give the members of the committee, a study pattern here? You have, you've given us a packet. We have the general idea of what the bill was supposed to do. Can you zero in, as it were, on the proposed amendments? Are they technical in nature, or could you go through what...
Yes, but I just for a couple minutes, I'd like Jack to respond because it's important to understand where the bill came from.
Why don't I make a couple of comments while Barbara's trying to vector in on those two or three issues? For the record, Jack Monroe with the Oregon Association of Realtors, and really in response to the question that Senator Simmons raised, the Oregon condominium law has been around since 1963. And so in direct response, I guess, to your question, Senator, it was not the result of a model act. But I would say that in first beginning in the interim between 1975 and the 77 session, and then in sessions or in interims since then, a group of people, and sometimes a varied group, has been involved in making or attempting to draft and refine the existing unit ownership law. And particularly starting in that 75 interim, we had a collection of people, including some people from the academic world, some lawyers, some title people, the insurance commissioner, the real estate commissioner, and some development-oriented people who worked on the two bills that passed during the 77 session, House Bills 3101 and 3102. They basically provided in 3101 a complete revision of the process by which you submit property to condominium ownership. And in 3102, what was and is the existing portion of the law that deals with the consumer protection aspects of the bill. And things like disclosure and whatnot are not new to the condominium law with this session. We came back last session with another series of amendments in an attempt to refine it, and some, at least some of the members here, Senator Hannon, I know, will recall that, in what was then House Bill 2968. As a result of that process, and as a result of in fact, just experience with the law as this kind of ownership became more prevalent, we, some of us, incurred an obligation to look at a limited number of topics during this past interim. And frankly, House Bill 3132 is the product of that deliberation. And it was a bill that we presented to at least to certain members of the House Judiciary Committee who in turn sponsored it, hence the language on the bill. So I guess in a rather lengthy way, that's, for your benefit, Senator Simmons, an explanation of where the bill came from. I think beyond that, in the couple of seconds that are left, Barbara will point out the series of amendments. I commend those amendments to you, and Barbara, in fact, really is the drafter of most of the legislation that you see there, and the amendments are amendments that I think, by and large, she. I'll simply let Barbara speak for herself.
Okay, everybody has, I think, an engrossed copy of House Bill 3132, and then the right-hand side, upper right-hand, proposed amendments, Real Estate Division, July 13th, 1981.
Correct, and I don't expect you to read all that other material, but once in a while something comes up, and it's just helpful to say that is a declaration, so I put it in for reference. I'll start with what I want to take out. There are a couple sections on page 12 and 13 that will attempt to deal with a gray area of the law on how you partially remove property. We haven't had a lot of problems, but we anticipate a few more coming up. And subsequent to putting the introduction of 3132, we've had a few more circumstances and we realized that this might not be the best way, and we'd rather just not do anything until we're all sure of the proper procedure, and we've gotten along this long. So we're suggesting that Section 17 and 18 be deleted, and we can live with kind of playing it by ear on procedures between now and when we're comfortable with proposing a specific procedure to remove part of a condominium. So that's what we're suggesting, that those sections in the entirety be removed. There are some odds and ends that you just glanced through that are just cosmetic and a couple just minor things that I think on the face are quite obvious. The biggest issue that we have is, and this didn't get toward the end, didn't get all worked out. Under the current law, there is ability for a buyer to rescind, get out of his deal. And we were trying to deal with several problems of of when the rescission right started and whether the extension was from three, the existing law from 3 to 5 days. And I guess I'll quickly say that the amendment starting on page 14 and 13, 14, and 15 with a 14A insert finally tuned that a little bit better. The amendment that was made in the House side was an amendment that started off with something that we had proposed and we didn't get back to really hash it out any further, and after that time it's come clear that the mechanics of it just is going to cause one particular group some problems. And so the proposal that I have included now we think is a very good way. It addresses several things up front. We're mandating in the law that the buyer get a public report. We're mandating now, which was an alteration from the current law, that the various documents regarding the condominium, the declaration and bylaws, be given at an earlier time. And we are certain that it is the intent that those people get those documents. So we're simply tying the rescission period to getting those documents, the public report and the various condominium declaration and bylaws, and simply saying when you sign a sales agreement, you haven't got those documents. Your sales, until you get them, your rescission period doesn't run. And that way it will be very clear that if you don't get those documents, then you're going to have a right to rescind until you get them. There is an overall cutoff time at closing, but what we fear is that the buyer will sign the sales agreement, and even though the statute says they are to get the documents, it doesn't say they have a right to rescind after they get the document. So 14A is just trying to put up front the way we think everybody really intends it to be, that the buyer is going to be able to take advantage of his rescission period until he gets the public report, that's the disclosure statement issued by the real estate division, and a copy of his enclosed with that material, the declaration and the bylaws. And then if he has that information before he signs his purchase agreement, that's fine. If he signs his purchase agreement before he gets all that information, then when he receipts for getting that information, he's going to then have 5 days to decide that maybe he doesn't want to be obligated. And we think this is a cleaner way to do it, and our office is much happier with it. And I don't think the realtors, I don't know that Jack has tested them, but we haven't heard any opposition to the people we've tried to run it past. But I don't want to speak for anybody but our office and the folks that we've asked to look at it.
Yeah. Closing could conceivably take place within 5 days after one of these A, B, or C's.
It's possible, but unlikely.
It's unlikely. I would
Very unlikely. And I will say,
the documents were not delivered for 30 or 60 days, and closing could set up anyway.
Right. The law right now requires that the developer deliver those documents before closing. Right now, and of course, that's what we've said. It's not very realistic that the person comes in with all these papers at closing, that's the time. Many, many, many times they're given out earlier. But, you're not in violation of the statute, if the statute says closing, and so we want to encourage it earlier on. Now, many, many times, I can't imagine, I suppose it would be possible that something would close in 5 days, but it would be very, very unlikely.
What I'm looking at is the top of page 15, the purchaser's right to cancel the terminates at the time of closing.
Right.
And if the 5 days starts to run after he gets the public report, so presumably if he got the public report on the 20th and closed on the 21st, he would only have 1 day to let that report over.
We have suggested that the time frame on giving the public report and the documents out, and I hurriedly was trying to sort of generalize, but because I know of your session, 4 o'clock time, we're saying the developer must give the public report out, and he must give those documents out not later than the time the sales agreement is fully executed. So he's supposed to give them out before the sales agreement is binding on everybody, and that's a strange kind of terminology, but we know that a lot of times the offer comes into the seller and it's signed before he really knows about it.
Let me ask you this question.
Yes.
Could we perhaps make some change here so that the new language which you proposed on 14A would more clearly correspond with the new language, which is subsection 7 at the top of page 15?
Okay, that this provision was put in on the House.
Well, I'm wondering, is there...
And I was kind of...
Adjustment can be made here so that there's no conflict between those?
Well, you could take that language out. It's we didn't initially propose it. That it came up in response to the other planning and development bill, and
so we might just cancel the.
You could take it out. You could take it out. It was an extra safeguard, just for lenders' benefits. But our group didn't initially put it in. But I'm more comfortable with it. I'm more comfortable with it in, and I just think the thought of the 5-day period being closing occurring that quick is just remote. Now I will corresponding with this issue, and I suspect that the realtors may have a comment, but our office was not comfortable. Here again, you have to remember, we, though we were involved in this, we didn't totally agree on every section in it. Our office.